Hello and welcome to Enterprising Investor, the flagship investment podcast for CFA Institute. I'm Mike Wahlberg, and we have something a little different for you on the show today. We're going to step away from the usual question of how to invest better to earn higher returns and make more money to focus a little more on the why, as in what role does money play in happiness? And maybe how can your state of mind impact your investing success? To talk us through this topic, Dr. Meir Statman is with me today. Dr. Statman is a professor at the Levy School of Business at Santa Clara University. And looking at his bio, he's probably published in every financial journal you can name. His list of advisory appointments and awards is equally impressive, but beyond all that, Meir recently published A Wealth of Well-Being, A Holistic Approach to Behavioral Finance. Barry Ritholtz, whom many listeners of this podcast may know from his Bloomberg podcast, Masters of Business, wrote this about the book. There are few people in the world better situated to help us make better decisions about our financial well-being than Professor Statman. He has already taught us what investors really want. Now, more importantly, he is teaching us how to make better decisions about our life well-being. We're going to focus on the findings of that book in our chat today. Welcome to the show, Meir.
Oh, I'm delighted to be with you, Mike.
So, Meir, could you outline the general focus of the book?
Yes. So I often note that the biggest risks in life are not in the stock market. I say, if you want real risk, get married. And if you want more risk, have children. And people laugh, as you do right now, because the point is obvious. And yet that point gets lost when we speak about financial well-being and we overlook life well-being. And of course, life well-being requires financial well-being. We need money for supporting a family and, of course, supporting us. But we know that money is not sufficient. Family matters. Marriage, children, work matters. Health matters. Education matters. Religion. So there are many parts, many domains to well-being. And so one of the things I wanted to do in this book is expand that circle of finance beyond financial well-being to include life well-being, which is really the ultimate of it. Financial well-being matters greatly. It underlies family, it underlies health, it underlies everything. But well-being goes beyond wealth, goes beyond financing. And almost all people have those points of pain. Very few, if any, have perfection in each of those domains. And we learn to transfer well-being medicine from one domain to another. And we learn to accept medicine from other people by speaking to them about their issues, and we can offer well-being medicine both in compassion but also in volunteer work that helps people.
It's something that I've found interesting in your book was just this idea where, you know, you had various sources there where you quoted people in there who make themselves vulnerable by sharing those things. And when you speak of those injuries, it creates a sort of intimacy and a friendship that encourages them to open up.
What I do in the book is I bring that scientific literature that is done with large samples and so on. It is really general, but very useful. And I marry to it those stories that you can read in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Atlantic Magazine and so on that illustrate, really, that provide those insights. And people indeed open themselves, make themselves vulnerable by sharing their issues, their pains, their injuries. And I was thinking, you know, I should do the same so that readers can see. I'm not kind of one of those people who comes and says, the most important thing about well-being is marriage or friendship, or it is all of those things. And those things, not all of them can be perfect. And so what we need to do really is live in reality. And reality is kind of, it's sort of like when you buy a new car and you have the first ding. Well, you know, it is really painful. But then when you have the second and third and fourth, you say, who cares? All cars have dings. At least it takes me from home to work and back, and you relax about that. And so if we can kind of look at that and take lessons for ourselves and say, you know, God did not choose us to inflict that pain because we are particularly sinful. All people have that pain in different parts of their lives, and we learn to live with it.
So what is the relationship then between financial well-being and life well-being?
Well, so it is really very important to note that financial well-being underlies all of well-being. And so, you know, sometimes you'll see those books, you know, that say that money doesn't really matter much. Well, it matters a great deal. First, it matters on its own. Having money means that if you get a ding in the car and more, if it is destroyed, you can still afford to buy a new car. And money also provides those expressive and emotional benefits in high social status. And so it really matters to us, not just how much money we have, but how much money we have relative to our social comparison group, say our neighbors or coworkers. And so money enhances well-being, period. But money also underlies well-being in the other domains. As I said, you need money to take care of family, to buy clothes for children, to have a house for yourself and for them. You need money to pay for health. You need money to pay for education. You even need money for religion, because if you're going to be a member of the congregation, they're going to pass the basket, and you better have something to put in it.
And I think, if I might say, Mayer, as well, as they say that, you know, one of the biggest causes of divorce is often money, right? That what people fight most about is usually about money. And it's, I guess, it's sprinkled across all of those other categories that you're talking about. If you don't have the sort of base layer, I guess, of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if you're not satisfying the basic things and getting the car fixed and buying the groceries, everything else can kind of fall apart.
Indeed. Yeah, that is true. And that is a reason that many poor people either don't marry in the first place or split, because it gets to be too much when one, say, has a job, comes home stressed, there is still not enough money, and so on. And that bleeds into everything, into relationship, and often leads to divorce.
So this idea of achieving financial stability so that you can achieve happiness in other areas of your life, that makes intuitive sense to me. I'm curious if that relationship exists in the other direction. So does having a stable marriage, fulfilling friendships, a sense of community, can that lead to better decision making in whatever role you are? And, you know, our listeners, a lot of them are portfolio managers in that portfolio management seat.
Well, I think it does. I think that not having the stress of poor well-being helps you focus on what really is important. To me, this means that, for example, I don't need to buy Bitcoin to be wealthy. I am wealthy. Now, I understand how people, young people who don't have much, aspire to really be wealthy, and they don't really see a way for them to be wealthy with just working steadily, saving, investing, and so on. They would like to be wealthy, and they would like to be wealthy now. And they end up making decisions that, in fact, are diminishing their financial well-being as well as their life well-being. I understand that, you know, because the risks that we take are not just in money. That is, I think about risk when I think about the decision that I made years ago after I completed my studies at the Hebrew University in Israel and got a job as a financial analyst. And a few months later, I just realized that that's not the kind of job for me. And I came to the United States to get a PhD, not really knowing what comes next. Now, objectively speaking, I was taking a huge amount of risk. I had a steady job. If I stayed there, I would have had a pension. I was already married. We already had a baby. But I was driven to get something, a job that is a vocation that pays enough to sustain myself and the family. And so I didn't really think about risk. I was thinking about my aspirations. And so I think that what I would say to younger people is invest properly. That is, invest in education, invest in finding a vocation, save, invest wisely. Don't do it by lottery ticket. Don't do it with Bitcoin.
And lottery tickets famously bought by the people least able to afford them.
Exactly. But again, we tend to sort of say, they're not very smart. They're very smart. They are as smart as we are. It is just that they are at the point where we were perhaps years before. They can see that they're not going to establish the next Google or even become a professor. How is it that they have a chance to get beyond what they have now? And for many people, the only reasonable answer is a lottery ticket. And, you know, as long as you have that as one every week or one every month, it is okay. As long as you don't overdo it, it is perfectly okay to keeping hope alive.
And I feel like what we're talking about here, a little bit here, is risk. And it actually takes me into another question that I wanted to ask you about, which is something you write about in the book, is this main motivators for investors, which is the prospect of riches and the prevention of poverty, sort of these kind of two dual goals that all investors have. And I wonder if you could walk us through how you think about, you set up a simple portfolio. So I wonder if you could talk about what that simple portfolio is comprised of and how investors might weight the different things based on where they are on that continuum of seeking wealth versus trying to just cover rent.
Yeah, so I like to say with obvious exaggeration that we want two things in life. One is not to be poor and the other is to be rich. And so we can kind of build our portfolios and build our lives as well based on that. And so going to life first. So I came to the United States. I took a risk. Perhaps I would not have finished my PhD. Perhaps nothing would have come with it. I would have had to go back to Israel and perhaps do the kind of job I did not like. But at least I knew that I'm not going to be poor. That is, I have enough skills to make sure that I have food on the table. And so it is important to have that base. For young people, it is mostly what we call human capital, that is their ability to earn money. But there's also to be rich. And when I talk about rich, I'm not necessarily talking about rich in money. I'm talking about really rich in well-being. And so we care about finding, for example, a job that is a career and is a vocation, something that brings us satisfaction beyond paycheck. And I think that the same applies to portfolios. And so, you know, many people rebalance, you know, they have an attitude towards risk. I don't have an attitude towards risk. I have aspirations and I have those desires not to be poor and to be rich. And so, you know, if you think about kind of two layers, one is for not being poor. It can consist for young people. It is mostly their human capital. They don't really have much in the way of portfolio. They can invest, in fact, everything that is beyond that in risky things like the stock market. When we age, we use, say, bonds to create this downside protection, this not being rich layer, and then have stocks as the upside potential, as the getting rich. And so that's what I do. So I have enough in those bonds to tide me over for us comes to worse in the stock market. But then the stock market goes up and down every day. I am wealthier some days than other. I pay no attention. It really does not matter. I know that I'm fine. And it's just really funny how we look at monies in different pockets. And so it really matters to me if I've got shortchanged by $10 in some store, and yet my portfolio goes up by thousands or down by thousands every day, and I just shrug my shoulders.
And I guess the timing can also be an important part of that. I really loved in the book, you told a story about a Wall Street Journal article that you wrote. And in it, you wrote, "Reader of an article I wrote in the Wall Street Journal noted the upside of diversification. He said, getting rich slowly has seemed to work for a lot of folks, getting rich quick for a slender few. And a fellow reader noted the downside of concentration. You can get poor just as quickly." Can you talk about this concept of allowing simplicity and time to do the heavy lifting?
Yeah, I think that, you know, they say, and it is correct, that diversification is the only free lunch in finance. And so when I hear people who are talking about the Magnificent Seven and how they figured out the FANG or the Magnificent Seven or whatever it is now, I kind of smile to myself because I know that they are in my portfolio, that I have those stars in my portfolio and they're making me money. And if they make up a large portion of my portfolio because it is weighed by market value, so much the better. But I don't try to figure out whether it is going to be Magnificent Seven 1 year in Amazon and the like, and the other, it is going to be Exxon and the like. I just have all of them. And so I let time do the job. Now, I do have the luxury of being older, of course, and having seen how compounding works. And so when I was a student at Columbia, I also taught at the City University of New York, and they opened for me a retirement account, and they put perhaps as much as 15% on top of my measly salary into it, and I added some. And this amount, these few thousands, are now hundreds of thousands. Yes, we've had inflation between then and now, but even now, hundreds of thousands are real money. It is hard to tell young people that, you know, when you're 20s and you hear someone who is in his 70s, you say, oh, those old geezers, what do they know about life? And life has changed so much and all of that. But, you know, it was useful for me when I was young to listen to just so much older people, but listen to what science is telling us about investing and behave accordingly and enjoy the fruit of it now.
Yeah, those portfolios are really the best, the kind of forced savings and forget about them. And, you know, you open them one day and you by virtue of not touching them, you've managed to save yourself from yourself.
Indeed. Yeah, it is right that we are the enemies of ourselves when it comes to investing. You know, I really, people say, what is your investment philosophy? I say, I have no philosophy. There's no investment philosophy. There are investment biases, there are investment stupidities, but there is also investment science. And what I try to teach my students is the science of investors. And so when I start the course in investments, I ask them what they expect to know at the end of the course. And invariably, some say how to beat the market. And I say, you know, you're not going to learn that from me. If you want to learn from somebody, choose another course. What I'm going to tell you is how you're going to really accomplish financial well-being and life well-being without being able to beat the market, just be with the market rather than try to be above it.
So as you think about, you know, your students and yourself and your parents, like what generational differences? I'm curious. So what did you observe in terms of in your research or in your daily life around risk tolerance and portfolio construction?
Well, You know, when I was young, in fact, there were some people when I was a student at the Hebrew University who bought American stocks with Israeli currency, and it was kind of a complicated thing. But it was pretty rare, and I did not do it. Today, with Robinhood, everyone can be an investor, and indeed, many, many have been flocking into it. And if they learn, if people learn, if young people learn to invest well, that is, create reasonable portfolios and leave them alone, that would be wonderful. And so the problem of younger people now is that they can use their iPhone, click a few things, buy stuff, sell stuff, and eventually dwindle their portfolios. But what is really more stable is this issue of aspiration. When I was young, as I said, I had aspirations, and in fact, I had low well-being because my situation was much lower than my aspirations, and I was striving to reach my aspirations. And that is what young people today are doing, and that is why I empathize with them. The nice thing about growing old is that you lower your aspirations sufficiently to get closer to your situation. And so now, you know, things that used to annoy me when I was young, here is somebody who did not just fail to cite my article, but essentially redid my article without mentioning my work. You know, I would send a polite email saying, you know, you might be interested in this article, hoping that they'll get the hint. Now, I don't do that. You know, I let those things slide. So there are advantages. In fact, we know that well-being has this U pattern, like the letter U, where it is going down until middle age, until, say, mid-50s, and then begins creeping up, not because people have achieved what they really wanted, but because they say, you know, I've achieved enough and I should just relax. And I pity those people who are still striving, not just striving, I strive, but are made miserable by feeling that they still have some mountain that they have to climb, rather than realize that they have a lot and that there are people who have less. And that the way they gain well-being is by enhancing the well-being of other people.
So you mentioned, Meir, that your first job in the industry was as a financial analyst back in Israel. If you were to go back on your first day and take yourself out for coffee, what key piece of advice would you offer yourself?
Well, I would say to young people to strive. I say, sacrifice some of your well-being now for better, higher well-being in the future. And so get an education, go to college, go to graduate school. Your kids, your friends are going out to parties. You stay home to get ready for an exam. You really envy them, but you have to know, you have to look forward and know that at some point they may well envy you. And so just make risks or take risks that are useful. That is, not all risks bring rewards. Some risks bring rewards. For example, the risk you take when you acquire education, the risk you take when you switch jobs, when you go to another state or even another country. These are useful kinds of risk. They are not day trading kind of risk. And so I say, you know, forgive me if I sound like an old fogey, because I am, but I've learned something along the way. And those things that I've learned have been learned by people my age everywhere. You might resent it now, as I remember resenting some of the advice my mom gave me. But eventually I remember my mom and I said, you know, Mom, I wish you were here so I can thank you once more for that good advice you gave me so many years ago.
Amazing. I've been speaking today with Professor Meir Statman, respected researcher, expert, and professor at Santa Clara University, and author of A Wealth of Well-Being, A Holistic Approach to Behavioral Finance. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today, Meir. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much, Mike. It's wonderful to speak with you and with the listeners.
I'm Mike Wahlberg, and this has been The Enterprising Investor.